I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Stop wasting money on the things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Washington Post. That's rocketmoney.com/Washington Post.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and this is Cape Up. Rebecca Carroll rocked my world with an op-ed in the Washington Post entitled, "As a Black Woman Raised by White Parents, I Have Some Advice for Potential Adopters." Her advice was as blunt as it was raw, and it was a microcosm of her book, Surviving the White Gaze, a memoir, all about how she went from the cute, precocious black adopted daughter of white parents who created an idyllic world of their own to a black girl and woman trying to navigate the world as it is. This is a terrific conversation I cannot wait for you to listen to right now. Rebecca Carroll, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I had to get in touch with you after reading your incredible, incredible op-ed in our paper, in the Washington Post. The headline is, "As a Black Woman Raised by White Parents, I Have Some Advice for Potential Adopters." Let's start from the 50,000 foot level. Why write this piece?
So as soon as people started talking about this racial reckoning, I thought, well, are we reckoning or are we reckoning, right? And transracial adoptees, particularly Black transracial adoptees, have an integral perspective on race and reckoning. We have lived, especially adult Black adoptees, have lived in this foundational dynamic in which we are trying to be connected and trying to also be who we are while also mitigating oftentimes our white family's racism. And so that perspective, I think, is really important in this moment as we try to build on reckoning with race and changing the way that we talk about race and racism.
Okay, we're gonna pull back to 75,000 foot level and talk about the book that was the inspiration for this op-ed. And the name of your book is "Surviving the White Gaze: A Memoir." So before we get into the things that you put into the piece, tell the listeners, Who are you?
Oh, and thank God I know. Because I don't recommend writing a memoir unless you know who you are. I am a woman who was adopted as an infant into a white family, white parents who were artists and naturalists and hippies who had had two biological children and wanted another. Because they had no conventional framework in place, it was easier to adopt a child of color. And then a sort of serendipitous, you could say, or insane, you could also say, circumstance presented itself where my adopted father was an art teacher in high school, and one of his students became pregnant with her Black older boyfriend. And she didn't have a plan. And my dad said, here's what we would like to offer you. She changed her mind. She agreed. And then she changed her mind. And then she changed her mind again. My adoption did not become legal until I was three. And then at 11, I reunited with her. That's the nutshell. But also, not just raised in a white family, but in a rural white town, an all white town. I was literally the first Black resident of the town as an infant in 1969.
And this is in the state in New Hampshire.
That's right.
So not only a white state, like a very white state. And you met your birth mother at 11.
Yeah.
And if I remember correct, I watched your interview with Trevor Noah, and in that you said you didn't meet another Black person until you were six.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a dance teacher, a ballet teacher, who had a small studio in a town / small city about 20 miles away. And I write about this in the book, of course, but just having this moment prior to meeting her, I had seen Electric Company. I had seen Easy Reader on uh-huh. Electric Company, and had this moment of just like, I mean, it was almost terrifying how attached I felt to his visage and then hers without having any real context for why, right? And because it would, as I said, you know, it felt like being in community, I say that now, I didn't know how to say that then, with Blackness meant giving something up. And what that was, what that would have been, and I would have given up, is the kind of proxy and proximity to whiteness, where that will make you believe it's going to have your back or save you, but never does.
Ooh, talk more about that.
Well, so when I was really young and precocious and cute, you know, my parents and their friends all thought that I was just darling, just this beautiful gem, this exotic child. And then when we kind of left this bubble of where we spent the first 6 years of my life in this farmhouse on Pumpkin Hill, which was every bit as idyllic as I write about. That's why I opened the book with that chapter, because we lived in this bubble that was almost curated in a way. You know, it was stunning, and it was imaginative, it was creative, it was void of race, but for me. And so when we moved to another place, and within a year or two, my fifth grade teacher told me that I was very pretty for a Black girl, and that most Black girls are ugly, unattractive. So my point in the proximity to whiteness is that my parents and their friends chose to see me in a certain way. They chose to not see my Blackness, which ultimately did not protect me from my teacher. It's racism, my friend's racism, another teacher's racism. But there is this idea, this false notion that whiteness, and this is a function of white supremacy, of course, will protect you if you're on their side. Mm-hmm. But they never do in the end, at the end of the day.
And you know, not to harp on Trevor's terrific interview, but I think it was in that interview where you talked about, you just mentioned another teacher's racism. Were you referring to your prom date's father, who is a history teacher?
History teacher. That's right. U.S. history. Mm-hmm.
Would not let him take you to the prom.
So it was, and it's almost ridiculous. And I sort of riff on that in the book, which is that he forbid him. Right. And I was like, forbid him? Like, whose parents forbid their kid from going to the prom? Why forbid? But yes, he was absolutely determined to stop his son from taking me. You know, we went anyway, but it was, okay. The fun was, you know, it had gone, the ship had sailed.
Mm-hmm. The thrill is gone. So you just mentioned a moment ago how to your parents' friends, at a certain point, you were this young, cute, precocious, exotic creature in their midst, you know, their friend's cute exotic daughter. At what age, or what was the incident where you went from being cute and precocious to, I don't know, a 4-foot Angela Davis?
Right. Absolutely that, what you just said. I do think it was that moment where, you know, my friend and I were playing. It was recess. It was, you know, in the fifth grade, we were 10 years old. And we went to pause and see how much more time we had. And the teacher on duty said, on chaperone duty said, we have a little more time. And she said to my friend, you're such a pretty girl. And then she looked at me and she said, you're pretty too for a Black girl. And that was the outfacing racism. But what I internalized was what she said after that, which is that most Black girls are very ugly, are unattractive. And so that was the moment where I was like, you know, my friend and I looked at each other like, what is she talking about? I don't, like, you know, and I didn't have any way to engage with that. Nobody was talking about how I would be perceived or how I would need to manage myself or these kinds of, you know, I felt sometimes as I was writing the book, like Neo from, you know, The Matrix, like just like, you know, like getting these, you know, right. These things flown at me and just dodging them and coming, standing back up. But that's what it felt like because I only had myself.
Your parents didn't talk to you about anything race related. Didn't, like for me, you know, my mom sat me down for the talk. You didn't have any kind of talk. No talk whatsoever.
You can be damn sure I sat my own son down for the talk.
Yes, but your own parents, not for a moment. They pretended wasn't there.
It was not there, but I love that you said, when did you become a 4-foot Angela Davis? Because it did feel that way. Like it's, when I started to be inquisitive or, you know, how am I going to manage this is what I started to think. Like, where are my resources? Like, and so I would say to my parents, what were you thinking? I'm really curious. Like, what were you thinking? And they would say, you know, it was this time of hope where Martin Luther King was bringing everybody together, right? And I'm like, yeah, and then he was shot, right? Like, so then what, you know? And I didn't really realize how much of a burden it was to them for me to press and push. And it's, you know, it's become literally my life's work, right? But as a kid, as a teenager, as in my young 20s, as I was trying to navigate this existence and this identity, you know, it was just exhausting, absolutely exhausting. You'll read in the book, I think, I don't know whether you've had a chance to read it all or not, but you'll see the arc of when I sort of hit a wall of like, oh, okay.
I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Stop wasting money on the things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Washington Post. That's rocketmoney.com/Washington Post.
Well, okay, so I have not read your book because my first interaction with you was through the opinion piece in the Washington Post. And so now that people have a sense of who you are and your story and your history, now what you write in the piece, they have something to hang on to understand where is this coming from? What gave your and what gives your piece in the op-ed piece so much power is that it's unflinching. What you write is unflinching. And you just mentioned Martin Luther King. Your parents said, you know, it was a time of hope and Martin Luther King. And you said, well, he got shot. And one of the things you write in the piece is, good intentions are not parenting skills, and Martin Luther King Jr. did not die so you could use your admiration for him to defend your failings.
Well, you know, I mean, that's a two-parter there, right? Which is that Martin Luther King gets evoked all the time by good white liberals as a way of sort of saying, you know, we care, we are liberal, Black Lives Matter. I mean, he gets used for a lot. And it just, after a while, just pisses me off. You know, it's not, he didn't do what he did for you to then just pick and choose when you evoke him to cover your own failings. That good intentions are not parenting skills. They just aren't. And period, across the board, whatever your racial makeup. But when it comes to, again, going back to this foundational dynamic, right, of white people making choices for Black folks who don't have a voice. Now, obviously, as I said in my interview, since we're referring to the Trevor Noah interview, I'm not likening transracial adoption to slavery.
Right.
I am saying that the dynamic between Black and white people is foundationally, the power differential is foundational. And so when it plays out in workspaces, in any space, but particularly in a family, it's really hard, and it requires rigorous interrogation, compassion, empathy, discomfort, you know, and that's the choice you're making. And I think that there's a whole, you know, a whole wave, a whole generation of at my parents' age, who thought we're doing this amazing thing, we're doing this great thing, and it's all about love, and love will be the answer, and love is lovely, as I wrote in the piece, but it does not shield from the deeply rooted systemic, you know, racism and white supremacy in this country. It just doesn't.
There's another, and here's another one that when I read this, I was just like, damn. You write, please do not suddenly start acquiring Black friends after you adopt a Black child. And if you didn't have any to begin with, meditate on that.
Can you, I mean, really think about it, Jonathan. Can you imagine, like, how would that make sense? Like, suddenly I know how to raise a Black person, a Black child into a Black adult, but I don't have any Black people in my life. That just makes absolutely no sense to me. And the idea of just then acquiring or you know, searching for, I mean, first of all, Black folks are going to be on to you, right? You know, I have spoken to my share of white adoptive parents, and one woman said to me one time, she's like, well, I keep trying to be friends with Black people, and they just don't want to. And I said, yeah, I wonder
why.
Yeah, that approach is not going to work.
You go on to write, if you had a casual Black friend in college, but didn't maintain that friendship into adulthood, and only reference said friend when asked by your Black child why you don't have any Black friends as an adult, you're exploiting that Black friend to make yourself seem less racist, and that is racist.
Correct, right? That person, that relationship that you had, however 20 decades ago, is not yours to use. You don't get to then decide that person who you didn't cultivate a real relationship with, you get to exploit that? Like, that's unfair. And it's also racist.
You also have, talking to the adoptive parents, your naivete may be legitimate, but if you legitimately don't understand how systemic racism works, or the ways in which it will target your child specifically and often, then maybe you shouldn't adopt a Black child. And I mean that in the kindest way possible. That, and you know what? That is the kindest thing to tell potential adoptive white parents, that you have to understand what you're doing and how you're going to raise this Black child. Whether you don't see race or color or whatever, the world does. So you got to think about that.
It's also so presumptuous. It's just so presumptuous. And it also fits so tidily into the dynamic of this country, which is that, you know, white is right. And whatever white people decide, they set the tone, the standard, the canon of literature, the industry standard, the, you know, what is beautiful, everything. right? And so it's sort of like, well, we don't really have to, because ultimately whiteness is what is actually correct and what will win. And this goes back to, though, this notion of, for us, for Black adoptees, like, okay, so you've got our back, right? Like, that's what you're saying, you've got our back. But then when we grow up and start calling you out, you don't, right? Because right. ultimately right. it's, you know, do we really have to think about that? Do we have to? Well, you do, you know. I mean, one of the things that has been a struggle for me in writing this book is that, you know, my parents, or my mom especially, has said, you know, it wasn't a big deal. We just wanted another kid. And I'm like, this is the kid you got. This is the kid, right? So if you're not prepared to have a grown ass Black child who is calling out systemic racism, both in, you know, in the world and in your family, I mean, it's going to be really, really difficult.
Another thing you write is, please don't characterize us in ways that set us up for further stereotyping. Characterize how?
So I heard, and one of my, it's not a pet peeve, but it is definitely something that I think about a lot, and that is sort of the celebrity, white celebrities adopting Black children and raising them in these kinds of bubbles, real bubbles. Right, exactly. But one white adoptive mother said something on a talk show about her Black daughter, and she described her as a spitfire. And I just thought, that is not innocuous. If you are identifying your 9-year-old Black girl as a spitfire, she's going to internalize that. And then later she's going to be called a angry Black woman because they're connected. I think it's so important for people to understand how stereotypes manifest and how they become. And in this particular context, it's just, spitfire indicates there is, that she is unlawful or perhaps overtly even adult or adultified. You know, it was such a visceral response for me when I heard that. And I think we have to be, everybody has to be, but white adoptive parents need to be really mindful of their language. And mindful of how they don't know how to talk about their Black children, and then be willing to own that.
Well, let's talk more about language, because you also say be careful how you engage with modern tropes, or perhaps more pointedly, resist the urge to turn a phrase Black people made and love and feel good about into a trope. Black girl magic looks different through a white lens.
Yeah, I mean, and so does, you know, Black Lives Matter. That's why, I mean, we wouldn't have established these phrases or these ideas or this language if we didn't need it for each other and us, right? So, I mean, there's lots of conversation and op-eds and whatnot about the ways in which our phrases and words get co-opted, appropriated, exploited. But so I'm saying to white parents, don't do that, right? Don't use those things that we have made and that we want to keep for ourselves. I know that we can't fend off, you know, the Kardashians or mainstream America or pop culture from taking our language and our words, because that's sort of the MO of this country. But in the family, in your family, right? Like, I always cringe at white adoptive parents of Black girls particularly, but you know, when they post them on Instagram or whatever and be like, Black girl magic, it's like it's so cringy to me. It's not yours to say. And it's, you know, it's the same with what I was saying about hair, right? It's like, yes, learn how to do the hair, but also teach us how to do the hair, and then find someone who can have that ritual with your child, because it's so deeply important.
I remember by now, it's a little more than 20 years ago, white lesbian couple friends of ours adopted a little Black boy, biracial boy, so cute. And one of the first things they did, they called me and they said, okay, what do we need to do? Because he's black, and we want to make sure that, you know, we get this right or try to do it right. The first thing I said was, you got to find a black barber. And then I said, you must use lotion. Because if, I'm telling you right now, if a black woman or anybody black, but particularly a black woman, sees your child with ashy skin anywhere, they're gonna say...
Wait till you read my book. Yeah, totally.
They're gonna say something to you.
Yeah.
And she's still now Benjamin's in his 20s. And, you know, we still laugh about that. Last time I talked to one of the moms, we got a good chuckle out of that.
That's an interesting thing too, right? About, it's about ego too. You know, you have to set yourself, your ego aside, because you can't do everything. You know, of course, as parents, we want to be able to do everything for our child. But you, in this instance, you really, really can't, you know, and you have to be able to share some of that real intimate experience with somebody else who's not necessarily your family.
Right. So let's talk about putting ego aside for a bit, because you have said that in order to write your memoir, you had to, quote unquote, get grown. Mm-hmm. What did you have? Talk about what that means, to get grown. What did you have to deal with in order to actually do your memoir?
Oh, wowza. We talk about a lot about agency, of course, and truth and owning your truth and this and that. And I just, you know, I have a lot of younger adoptees say to me that it's, you know, that they can't believe how easy I make it seem that I'm in telling these hard truths. And I often say, do not underestimate maturation. you know, wisdom and growing, evolving, right? You know, being willing to evolve. And I think that's what I had to do. It very much, very much about becoming a mother myself, very much realizing, you know, there's an anecdote in the book where, you know, after Mike Ferguson was murdered, my son, who
in Ferguson,
Michael Brown, sorry, Mike.
Yeah.
After Michael Brown was murdered in Ferguson, my son, who was probably 9 at the time, said, are we going to get shot because we're black? And what that unleashed in me, the kind of rage and protectiveness and ferocity, the confluence of those feelings I had never experienced before. And then just the idea of how nonchalant my parents, loving, lovely people, talented, beautiful people, how nonchalantly they went about their lives and not thinking about Michael Brown or me or my children or, you know, when I was growing up. And it just, I never felt, and that made me feel like, okay, you're grown now. You're grown now. You're gonna tell your child the truth, and then you're gonna face some memories and stitch it together. And I very much thought this would be an offering to my parents. It has not been received as such.
And I was going to ask you about that in terms, you know, again, more about ego. Talk more about your parents' reaction. They go on. I'm not gonna put words in your mouth. You go ahead.
They're not happy. They have not received it in the spirit with which I wrote it. And that's tough, you know. But if having excavated, you know, 30 years of my life through, you know, I was a devout journaler, through journals and letters and, you know, my own vivid memory, and being as radically compassionate as possible. If they don't get it through that effort, then I have to let that be what it is, you know. And you know, I think for my dad, it's very much about ego. It's very much about him kind of, you know, deciding to create a world in which we lived according to his sense of beauty and the natural world and, you know, a sort of, he was a very, he has a very outsized ego and thought he was creating something extraordinary. And that's cool. And some of it was, but that doesn't mean there aren't going to be, your kids aren't going to have questions. In fact, the more extraordinary it is, I would say the more questions, you know, an engaged person would have. So yeah, it's been a little tricky.
A little tricky, but has it changed your relationship at all? Or is it, you know,
totally.
But in how so?
Well, my mom obviously there are factors involved, the pandemic and they're getting much older, but my mom used to come to New York from New Hampshire at least 4 times a year to visit. There is no talk of visits in the future. My dad and I don't speak. But that had started to unravel a few years ago when I first started to kind of bring these things up in the family, in, you know, when we would visit to New Hampshire when my son was very young. My son was starting to say things like, why is everybody white here? Why is there no indication whatsoever that my grandparents raised a Black child? You know, like he started to ask things, and it just became really hard to engage in a way that didn't make them feel defensive and that was, you know, intellectually, emotionally productive.
I'm sitting here writing myself this question to make sure I don't forget it, but it is, what does it say that even white liberals who adopted a Black child, like the message that you're sending in presenting in love doesn't get through? Even white liberals can't get there. Speaks to the power of white supremacy, I would think, or am I being hyperbolic?
No, and I think that's the last vestige, right, that people don't think about at all, which is white liberals are also enormously influenced and beneficiaries of white supremacy. You know, it's just prettier, right? It's just, you know, cuter. It's just more relaxed, you know? But it's absolutely indelible.
So then how do you, is there a way to have these conversations where white people don't get defensive? Mm-hmm. Or how do you, okay, you said, mm-hmm. How is that? How do you break through that?
Well, there's a couple of things. Usually in my experience, the way that it works is that, particularly if we're talking about white liberals, the first thing is, oh, I feel so bad. And then it's like, I don't like feeling bad. So see you later, next time there's a Black square to put up on my Instagram, right? But what I like to encourage is to lean into that, oof, this doesn't feel good. This feels bad. Because if you allow yourself to sit in that, people use the word discomfort. I really want people to feel bad. Like you really should feel badly, because what the dynamic that is happening is immoral. So feel bad, lean into that, because then you're going to figure out a way to not feel bad. Because that's what we do. That's what humans do. We're able to strategize. We're able to, our emotions are manipulative, easily manipulated. We can manipulate them. We can change them. We can build on them. We can seek out new language. But, you know, the combination of sitting in the feeling bad and then the work of building new language, I think is just so unappealing to so many white folks. Why would they, right? So that's the first scenario. The second scenario is that there are some folks who come into the world, my husband is one of them, who live their lives, create relationships and language through a sort of a self-awareness and an interrogation of the world around him. You know, oftentimes people, girlfriends and friends said, you know, A, did you manifest him? And B, he's the white family you deserved, right? Because he knows how to decenter himself and his whiteness, right? He is not woke. He thinks deeply and engages deeply with this history and this country and his partner and his child.
He had probably the coolest game when it came to meeting you. You wrote about this, I think it was in New York Magazine, 9 years ago, I think it was, where the whole point of the piece was you were writing about how when you were growing up, you were going to have a black husband, and that black husband was going to help you, you know, be in your blackness and everything, and it didn't work out that way. And here comes your now husband, who, and I noticed how you put in the piece, you dropped some gum on the platform.
I did.
Did you really drop the gum?
I truly did. Do you know the snap out gum, the Trident snap out gum?
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I snapped it out and it fell on the ground. It was unchewed. I absolutely did.
Okay.
And this guy walks up to me and says, someone's going to step on that. I was like, yeah, okay. And he said, well, I'll bet you a quarter that between now and the time the train comes, this is a subway platform in Brooklyn. I bet you a quarter someone's going to step on that between now and the time the train comes. So we're just standing there in silence and watching as people narrowly miss the gum. And then the train comes, the rumble of the train, and someone steps on it. So we get on the train. I give him a quarter. He's carrying an overnight bag. It's a Friday afternoon. I said, are you going away for the weekend to make small talk? Because also handsome. And he said, yeah, I'm actually headed up to Harvard for a conference on race and social policy. Jonathan, listeners, when I tell you my jaw dropped, because he said it with such ease and without looking for accolades or cookies, or I didn't realize what such white people existed, right? Who just care enough about it to have it as part of their language and their lives.
And as you write in New York Magazine, he was going to a conference on race and social policy, and you write, he had me at race and social policy.
He did.
race and social policy. Have you read the comments?
I stopped reading the comments a long ass time ago on places where I write op-eds and essays.
Great. So you also follow that rule of, like, why walk through a sewer if you don't have to? But I did, this goes back to putting ego aside. There are like 2,800 comments. And I've looked at 2,800 comments as of this recording. Yes, for real.
I did not know that.
A lot of them are, woo, chow. But there are a few in here who are basically saying, like, you know, perhaps her parents are the reason she's educated, or, you know, basically pointing out, you know, well, she seems ungrateful. What's your response? I'm sure these are two things you've not heard before. What do you say to folks who come at you like that?
Isn't it amazing how we are, the adoptees are always the ones who are meant to be grateful and to accommodate people who are uncomfortable with questions and concerns that we have raised about our own livelihood? You know, kids who are not adopted are grateful. We're all grateful. We all show that in different ways, but there's something about the dynamic, you know, of adoption where it's like, especially transracial adoption, where the assumption is that we would have been on the street with a cracked, you know, needle in our arm, had we not been adopted by these wonderfully loving, amazing white people. The other thing, I laughed when you said the comment about education, because with all due respect to my parents, nobody was less interested in my education than they were. And I don't mean that because they weren't educated themselves, but because they were hippies, because they were, you know, neither my brother or sister went to college. They couldn't, you know, we didn't have any money. It wasn't like they, you know, they were prepared to send me to college. We didn't have health insurance, you know, it wasn't. So I went because I wanted to learn. I wanted to find something. I wanted stuff. I was ambitious, you know, I wanted to be out in the world. And I knew that I had to do that by going to college. So that was on me. Thank you very much.
So I want to, I throughout this entire conversation, and especially when you're talking about white parents of Black children, adopted Black children, and, you know, dealing with the world that their children are going to be going into. And I keep thinking about now Vice President Kamala Harris's book, her memoir, The Truths We Hold, where she writes very lovingly about her mother in her memoir. There's one paragraph in there that just jumped out at me. She writes that her mother raised her and her sister Maya to be strong Black women because that's the way society would view them, even though they are Jamaican and Indian. But her mother, Shamala, understood that her new home country, the United States, was going to look at her two daughters as being Black. And I would love your thoughts on that, and whether that's something that every white parent who is, you know, wanting to open up their hearts and their homes to a Black child, that they have to go into it eyes wide open about that fact that they're adopting a Black child and what that means for that child.
I would say that what Shamala did is good parenting, right? And I think that what often gets lost is in adoption is that it's ways in which you parent involve a certain set of things, which is why I wrote this up to begin with, right? Your kind of parenting involves recognizing the way in which we will be seen and targeted and profiled in this country. Now, that doesn't mean that you know, never let us outside or that you translate that into something that makes you feel good. Again, it's about ego. It's about your kid. It's about how to best prepare your child to live a full and dynamic and interesting life. I mean, you look at someone, Kamala Harris, clearly well-parented, you know? And I think that it's just a matter of considering the various words of advice that I have given as part of your parenting. It should be integral to your parenting.
Rebecca Carroll, literally, we could sit here for another few hours and talk about this. This has just been so great and fascinating. Rebecca Carroll, author of Surviving the White Gaze, a memoir, and also the author of the Washington Post op-ed that generated this conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
the best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.